You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Right at the beginning of the interview,
I was wondering if you would have changed your mind.
To get roughly in the range of 195 to 25 to 10. That's the rough range.
Uh-huh.
Congress likely to get anything in the range of 85 to 95 seats. NDA would end up with something about 230, 235 seats. I don't see NDA getting a majority on its own as alliances stand today. UPA, who are the partners of UPA? It's very difficult to figure out at the moment.
Yeah.
But vaguely, if I recollect who are the partners of UPA, so UPA, with Congress having 85-90 seats, UPA cannot exceed 130-135 numbers. Rest all goes to other regional parties.
Well, why not start with a prediction? I thought that was Professor Sanjay Kumar telling us what to expect from the elections 2019. On today's edition of Digging Deeper with Money Control, we turn political and we are joined by a very special guest, someone who might be very familiar to you if you follow Indian politics on television. Professor Sanjay Kumar is professor and currently the director at the Center for the Study of Developing Societies. His core area of research is electoral politics, but using survey methods as a research tool, he's been engaged in conducting research on a very wide range of themes, including Indian youth, state of democracy in South Asia, state of Indian farmers, slums of Delhi, and electoral violence. His most recent book is Post-Mandal Politics in Bihar, Changing Electoral Patterns. His other publications include Changing Electoral Politics in Delhi, From Caste to Class, Measuring Voting Behavior in India, Indian Youth in a Transforming World, Attitudes and Perceptions, among many others. His articles are published regularly on a wide range of publications, including The Hindu, Indian Express, Asian Age, Deccan Chronicle, Dainik Bhaskar, Rajasthan Patrika, and The Mint. He's a familiar face on television as a sociologist and a political commentator, and now, hopefully going forward, even on podcasts. My name is Rakesh Sharma, and on today's edition of Digging Deeper with Money Control, we turn political, as I had a freewheeling conversation with Professor Sanjay Kumar on what the fortunes of the BJP and the Congress are going to be, what alliances are going to mean for these parties, and who may be at the driver's seat as of today, the 15th of March.
The Deep Dive podcast series,
an exclusive interview with Professor Sanjay Kumar, director of CSPS.
Welcome to the show, Sanjayji. To start things off, what we're about to witness is nothing short of a spectacle. 900 million voters, 1 million polling booths, millions of first-time voters, a once extraordinarily dominant party that has seen some of its clout dwindle a little bit, and of course, a splintered opposition. As a sociologist who has been engaged in predicting the outcomes of national and state polls for over two decades, what, as of the 15th of March today, are your predictions of how things might turn out?
As of today, my own sense is that NDA is well ahead of UPA. If I want to look at the two main political parties, BJP and Congress, my own sense is that BJP is sitting with roughly about 195 to 205, 210 seats. That's my range for BJP. And Congress in the range of roughly about 85 to 95 seats. My own sense is that Congress may find it extremely, extremely difficult to reach 100 figure. In nutshell, I think the gap between BJP and Congress, BJP is front-runner, BJP is the leading party in this election. Congress is the number two party, and the gap between number one and number two is going to be roughly 100 seats. That's my assessment as on the 15th of March.
In 2014's wave election, Sanjayji, what we saw was Modi challenging the UPA government's what he claimed were corrupt practices and the fact that things remained in a status quo, and he and the party ended up getting a majority, obviously. But this time going around into 2019, what do you think are going to be the key factors determining the election? Is it still going to be Modi's personality? And how do you think the opposition parties might be able to counter that?
See, in 2014, I think the key factor was anti-UPA, anti-Congressism. And I think there was a lot of anger, a lot of dissatisfaction against the UPA government. And Modi and BJP as a party were able to encash that anger in a very adequate manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why I think BJP managed to get a majority. This election, I think issues are going to be different for different political parties. BJP would like to go into election with this big slogan of nationalism, national security, and for national security, you need a strong leader. And India, at the moment, there is only one strong leader, who is Prime Minister Narendra Modi. This goes to the advantage of BJP. So BJP will like to pitch in this election on this issue of nationalism, national security, strong leader, Prime Minister Modi, everything around Prime Minister Modi. While on the other hand, Congress and regional party would like to focus the attention on the failure of the government. They keep referring to unemployment, they keep referring to growing dissatisfaction of the farmers, farm distress, farmers' mm-hmm. problem, and also at times issue of corruption with regard to the Rafael deal. The two blocks, and if I want to keep Congress and other regional party in one block, so the two blocks, one, BJP tries to always focus on nationalism, national issues, Modi. On the other hand, it is in the interest of Congress and regional party not to allow elections to be hijacked only on the national issues. They need to draw the attention of the voters on the local issues, the issues which matters to the voters at the ground. So the election issues are going to be different. It's not one issue election.
So I take your point about how the opposition party should keep it about the issues. But what has been happening, as we see of late, is that the BJP and Modi himself have been making Modi and his cult of personality the central issue. A similar thing happened in 2004, if not Vajpayee, who, and that, as we recall, did not quite go down as well as the BJP hoped it would. So even if the opposition parties do want to speak about the issues, but if the BJP is making it about Modi and his successes and his personality, how do you think the other political parties will be able to counter it? Do they just ignore it?
I think the best way to counter would be, I'm not saying that they should simply ignore when BJP is trying to hype Modi, BJP is trying to say that on one side we are offering Prime Minister Modi as a prime ministerial candidate, on the other end, who is going to be a match against Modi? I think in the interest of regional party and Congress would be, if at all they want to make any impact on the voters' mind, they should try and raise this issue of what this government promised when it came to power and what it has been able to deliver. If you look at the performance of the government standalone, this government is as good as any other government. The government is as bad as any other government.
Yeah.
I don't see that there is a strong anger against this government. People are saying that this government has ruined the country. I don't see this at all. At the same time, people are not in a celebratory mode that this government has, you know, done wonders to the development of this country. So what Congress and regional party needs to do is to draw the attention of the people that, look, the government's performance may just be okay, but look at what government has promised. And the BJP managed to win 2014 election largely on promises. So they promised several things and leave it to the voters to decide whether government has been able to perform well, average or bad compared to what they had promised. I think if this attention is drawn to the people, if people are able to make this judgment, I think people would be more critical about the performance of BJP rather than just Congress saying, you know, unemployment has increased, farm distress is on the rise, etc.
And I completely agree with you. I think it should be about the issues. But unfortunately, more often than not, that's not how Indian politics function. And of late, there has been another issue that has been brought up time and again, the success of the Modi administration in Balakot. As we know in the United States, what we saw with Bush, that if you want to gain popularity, wage a war. So whatever happened in Balakot, the success or the failure of it, that is still, of course, a matter of debate. How do you think that is going to play a role in this election?
There's no doubt that Balakot is only going to help BJP. It has only, you know, boost the prospects of BJP for 2019. But my own sense is that this is more in the urban areas, slightly less in the rural India. And also as we move closer to the day of election, closer to the day of polling, this is likely to subside to a great extent in rural India and also to some extent in urban area. While I don't discard BJP's ability to keep whipping up this nationalism fever and nationalism issue and keep reminding people of how government responded to the Balakot attack. But slowly and gradually, as candidates are announced, as campaign begins and then people go out to vote, this whole euphoria around Balakot, whole euphoria around nationalism is going to subside a little bit. But on the whole, Balakot can only help BJP. It's not going in the different direction. It's not helping regional party or the Congress. So Balakot incident definitely helps BJP to a great extent.
Well, related to Balakot, there has been another issue that's been brought up time and again, especially by the Congress and other opposition parties, about what happened exactly in Balakot. They're questioning whether the damage that was done was exactly the numbers that the BJP is claiming, and they're seeking evidence about what happened there. Do you think bringing that up is going to be something that'll help the opposition party, or just aid BJP even more?
I think more the opposition, more the Congress asks for or raises question mark about whether the attack ever took place or counting the number of dead bodies, asking government to give the evidence. I think more they will be damaging their own prospects.
Oh, good.
I think this is not the time for BJP, for the Congress and regional party to ask questions to the BJP, the government, on, you know, whether it was right, wrong, whether it was fictitious or whether it was true attacks. Maybe what regional parties and Congress can do at the best is to ask question about security failure and to ask question on, yes, government gave a reply to Pakistan, our Air Force led an attack, but what government has been able to do to investigate the security failure? There is a huge security failure if this is happening, such a huge amount of explosives. What government has been able to do in terms of instituting a kind of a committee to investigate why it happened, what happened, and who is responsible? Congress should at best put pressure on the government to say what has been the government's initiative on these fronts, rather than asking question about what the strike real or fictitious.
Perhaps that might be the cleverer move, because that debate of whether or not it was a true attack will just hijack the debate entirely and not probably result in gains for the Congress. But sticking to Jammu and Kashmir, the decision to not hold assembly elections simultaneously with the Lok Sabha elections has led to a bit of an uproar. Why do you think the center made the decision to not hold the assembly elections this time around, along with the Lok Sabha polls in Jammu and Kashmir?
I think it's not appropriate to say why. Even without saying why government has not been able to, why government decided not to hold election in Jammu and Kashmir for the assembly, I think we sense some kind of a politics in that, because I fail to understand how a state may be ready to vote in the Lok Sabha election, but the situation is bad to hold assembly election, which could have been held simultaneously.
That is true.
So if security is the reason, how can you hold elections for the Lok Sabha? So there is something, I think, as a journalist, we can realize, we can sense what is happening.
True.
Because once BJP, if BJP comes back to power in 2019, they think they would have a stronger footing in Jammu and Kashmir to hold elections, because the mood may be in favor of BJP, and then it may be an appropriate time to hold assembly elections.
Speaking of mood not being in favor of the ruling party, we saw that some of that mood might have dissipated in the Hindi heartland as well in the results of the recently concluded assembly elections. What do you think the mood of these states are going to be going into the 2019 elections? And do you think that dissipation of mood, as it were, is going to favor the Congress in any way?
No, if you look at the Hindi heartland, compared to 2014, Congress will definitely gain. There's no doubt that Congress will have gains in, say, Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, Gujarat, and few other states. But the question is, big question is, how much gain Congress can expect from these states, and how much damage BJP is going to face in 2019. I think the gains for the Congress may be less compared to what Congress is expecting, because of a simple fact. If you look at the assembly elections which were recently held in Madhya Pradesh, yes, Congress managed to form the government, but if we mechanically convert the assembly elections into a Lok Sabha election, this could be done very quickly. In essence, you club the assembly segments within one parliamentary seat, and we get the party position for the 29 Lok Sabha seats in Madhya Pradesh, 25 in Rajasthan, and 11 in Chhattisgarh. So if we look at that, the pattern is very clear. BJP still leads in 18 Lok Sabha seats in Madhya Pradesh, and Congress only in 11. And in Rajasthan, 13 seats BJP leads, and only 12. In 12 seats Congress leads over BJP. It is only in Chhattisgarh that Congress has a huge edge over BJP. By that calculation, Congress is leading in 9 seats and BJP leads only in 2 seats. What I'm trying to say is that BJP is still in a commanding position even after losing assembly election in Madhya Pradesh and Chhattisgarh, Madhya Pradesh and Rajasthan, not in Chhattisgarh. And those were assembly elections.
That's true.
This is a Lok Sabha election. And I would put 5% more votes as a premium for Modi leading the campaign, Modi being the prime ministerial candidate, and this election being held for the national government, not for the state government. So if we add 5% more votes to the vote share of BJP in Rajasthan and in Madhya Pradesh, BJP is likely to get more seats compared to what is the tally at the moment.
Right.
Tally means tally, if I convert assembly elections into
Lok Sabha
elections. It might look a little technical, but just to say, last elections, 2014, BJP had won all the 25 seats in Rajasthan, 26 seats in Gujarat. 27 out of 29 in Madhya Pradesh, and 9 out of 11 seats in Chhattisgarh.
Correct.
And there are other states like Delhi, all 7 seats, Uttarakhand, 5 seats, Himachal, 4 seats. So these are the Hindi heartland where BJP swept the poll.
Correct.
And I suspect that BJP may not lose large number of seats in the Hindi heartland because opposition is not united. We don't have any alliance in Delhi. Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, these are the states where Congress will be contesting alone. Congress doesn't have any alliance with smaller parties. And sometimes even alliance with some smaller party helps in consolidating anti-BJP votes.
Well, speaking of the Hindi heartland, I decided to ask this as a separate question because, well, Uttar Pradesh is where all the action happens in Indian elections. The bellwether state of the Indian elections, it also sends the most number of MPs to the Lok Sabha. Arch enemies are now friends because they want to take down the BJP together. BSP and SP have come together. Sanjayji, how much do you think this alliance is going to dent the prospects of the BJP in the most important state in the Indian elections?
See, in Uttar Pradesh, BJP is bound to go down.
Yes.
And now again, the only question is how many seats BJP can lose. I am looking at a three-way contest in Uttar Pradesh at the moment. And if there is a real three-way contest, I would say BJP still has an upper hand compared to SP-BSP.
I see.
My own sense is that out of 80 Lok Sabha seats, BJP is in a position to win roughly about 37-38 seats. SP-BSP might win roughly in the range of 34-36 seats. And Congress might end up with 2-4 seats. That's my assessment as of 15th March 2019. I would say BJP is still the front runner in UP in spite of SP-BSP forming an alliance.
So that is surprising, actually. I was thinking that the SP-BSP alliance did have an edge over the BJP considering the translation of what happened.
It's very difficult to make an estimate whether SP-BSP has an edge over BJP or BJP has an edge over SP-BSP.
Right.
I see them in a very tight contest.
Right.
But my own sense is that in this tight contest, the scales are tilted in favor of BJP at the moment.
Turning our attention eastward now, the BJP has obviously made a lot of successful inroads in the northeast. But with recent developments such as the NRC controversy and the Citizen Amendment Bill and now extending to Bengal, the standoff with Mamata Banerjee and the Trinamool Congress. Now, how do you rate the prospects of the BJP in view of all these recent developments?
First, we look at northeast. Northeast together, including Assam, counts for 25 Lok Sabha seats. Last time, BJP had won 8 out of 25. I see the possibility of BJP expanding in the Northeast, but not to the extent as BJP may be expecting kind of a gains from Northeast. I see at the best, BJP can add 7 or 8 more seats in the Northeast region. So from 8, they can go up to about 15 or 16, not beyond that.
Right.
Reasons are very simple. I see BJP maybe snatching one seat from AUDF in Assam and two seats from Congress because these are the three seats which BJP lost by small margin. And BJP will win two seats from Tripura. So these are the three gains from Assam, two from Tripura, and one seat in Meghalaya. But there are other seats where BJP would find it very difficult to win or snatch from other parties. So I see a gain of 7 to 8 seats for BJP in Northeast. In Bengal, BJP is heading for lots of gain. Again, the question is how many seats BJP is going to add to its tally compared to 2014. My own sense is I can clearly see BJP in West Bengal. It is going to be a two-way fight. So the real fight is between
Trinamool
Congress. But again, there is a catch. Trinamool is far ahead of BJP, though BJP is catching up fast. Finally, on the numbers, I think BJP is in a position to win roughly in the range of 8 to 10 seats in West Bengal. And if BJP manages to win 8 or 10 seats, this is an addition of 6 to 8 seats in West Bengal compared to the tally of 2 seats in 2014. And if we include Orissa also, though it doesn't fall in that category of Northeast in Bengal, but let me try and say something on Odisha as well. In Odisha, it is heading for a three-way contest, but it is a three-way contest of a different kind. When I say different kind, it is going to be a contest between BJP and BJP, and Congress is a poor number three.
Correct.
So I see BJP also making gains in Odisha. BJP is almost all set to win roughly in the range of 5 to 7 seats in Odisha. So the gains for BJP is coming from West Bengal, Odisha and the Northeast.
Now, Sanjayji, we've spoken about what the BJP's numbers might be in some of these states. Now, let's turn the gaze a little bit to the Congress. The Congress has decided to go it alone in some states, and in some other states it has made alliances. And the Mahagathbandhan that people were all expecting has not quite materialized in the way it was supposed to be. But of this strategy of going it alone in some states and making alliances in some others, do you think it's going to work in favor of the Congress?
No, it's not going to work in its favor. I'm very clear about that. Mm. I think we kept hearing about Mahagathbandhan, Congress forming an alliance, UPA emerging as a bigger alliance. But all this remained only on paper and nothing came out in concrete.
Mm.
And even in terms of forming an alliance, I think BJP managed to take 4 steps ahead of Congress. We were hearing about all kinds of issues between BJP and Shiv Sena, BJP and JDU in Bihar. And similarly about other parties. But look at AGP had just walked out of the alliance.
Correct.
In Assam. But look at finally what has happened. BJP managed to form an alliance in Bihar, even though there's some of their smaller allies moved out. But as soon as they sensed that their position may be weak in the heartland, they formed an alliance with JDU, conceding more seats to JDU. They formed an alliance with Shiv Sena, and they also formed an alliance with AGP. Even in terms of numbers, if you look at the number of parties with which BJP has managed to form an alliance, and these are strong parties in different states.
Correct.
BJP managed to form an alliance in Tamil Nadu much before Congress managed to form an alliance there.
Mm-hmm.
So even in terms of alliance, I think BJP managed to outsmart Congress.
Mm.
And Congress did not manage to form alliance in many states. We keep hearing news about what is happening in Delhi and what is happening in other states.
Mm.
It's kind of a ping pong ball going to and fro to and this side and that side. BJP has been successful even in this respect.
So perhaps sensing all of these things, the Congress hoped that the introduction of Priyanka Gandhi in politics and making her the secretary in Uttar Pradesh might reinvigorate the party and also perhaps attract female voters into the fray. But so far, what do we see as the plus points of the introduction of Priyanka Gandhi? Has it been a success for the Congress, or has it been, as a lot of the BJP members are calling it, a damp squib?
At least up till now, there are no signs of that.
Mm.
But there's still 6 weeks to go into elections. There may be some changes.
Mm.
But the problem with the Congress in UP is that even though Priyanka Gandhi is able to infuse the voters, infuse the party workers, and manage to add certain amount of vote to the party, but the difficulty is that the party is lying so low in Uttar Pradesh.
Correct.
Party has roughly about 7 or 8% vote. And if Priyanka Gandhi even manages to add 7, 8, 9, 10% vote to the existing vote share of Congress, that's not going to give Congress additional seats compared to what it won in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't rule out the possibility of Priyanka Gandhi generating some kind of a attraction towards Congress among various sections of voters.
Hmm.
But that won't be enough for Congress to win, to turn the popularity into seats, to turn votes into seats.
Right.
I think if Congress wanted to do this, they should have done this maybe an year ago. And
right.
All these strategies should have been devised. Priyanka Gandhi should have been brought into campaign maybe a year ago.
The Congress obviously hopes that Priyanka Gandhi might be able to bring back some charm to the party and attract female voters. But there has been a recent report that indicates that more than 21 million women have gone missing from the voter lists. As we know, that translates to about 38,000 missing women on average in every constituency in India. And in places like Uttar Pradesh, where Priyanka is campaigning, and Uttar Pradesh, which also happens to be the bellwether state, that figure swells to as many as 80,000 missing women in every seat. And given that one in every 5 seats are won or lost by a margin of fewer than 38,000 votes, the missing women could swing the elections in one way or another. So A, what do you think, Sanjayji, of the missing women from the voters list? And B, how do you think this can be corrected?
No, I have nothing to say on missing female voters because I'm not sure about this data. I haven't looked at this data. Why it would be so systematic in all the constituencies in the Eastern UP that we have missing women voters only.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little surprised about this and also very concerned if that has happened. Second, about the women voters.
Mm.
See, women voters have only shown an inclination towards 2 women leaders in the past. Past, in a sense, last 2-3 decades, which is one for Jayalalitha in Tamil Nadu and for Mamata Banerjee in West Bengal. Besides this, we have never seen women voters tilted in favor of any particular political party. There is a serious possibility of women voters getting attracted towards Priyanka Gandhi in bigger numbers now compared to the past. And if that happens, it adds women vote to Congress.
Hmm.
But again, I would say all this is not going to benefit Congress hugely, immensely, because Congress is lying very low. We should not remember that the threshold, you need a threshold for converting vote share into seat. Threshold, Congress is far below that threshold.
Moving away now a little bit from the parties and the elections itself, according to the Election Commission, the election is going to be held in 7 phases, which I suppose is an improvement from the 9 phases of 2014. But I, just like many other commentators have said on this issue, do not particularly agree that a country like ours should go into polls in 7 phases, especially when a single state has so many different phases going on within that state. What are your feelings, Sanjayji, about the election going on in so many different phases and so many different phases within single states?
When Election Commission announced the polls in 7 phases, they must have thought that they would get lots of congratulatory messages, because in 2014, the polls were conducted in 9 phases. I am very surprised. What is the rationale behind having polls in different phases? The mandate of Election Commission is to hold free and fair election. And the Election Commission says that since there are not adequate number of security forces available, you need to conduct the poll with limited number of security forces, and you cannot deploy all the security forces in adequate number to all the polling stations if you hold poll in one day. So you need polls to be held in phases so that you get enough time to move security forces from one place to another. And that's the whole logic of phased election. If that's the logic, then I fail to understand why a state like Tamil Nadu goes to poll on one day. This is one day poll.
A huge state, as it happens.
Yeah, 49. Bihar goes to poll in 7 phases. Odisha goes to poll in 4 phases. Assam goes to poll in 3 phases. So there is no logic. There is no logic behind why states like Assam, Odisha, or many other states, there are so many phases of poll. Second, if Election Commission managed to hold elections for 230 assembly constituencies in Madhya Pradesh only a couple of months back,
On one day.
So the number of polling stations remains the same in Madhya Pradesh. More or less, number of voters remain the same, etc. Assembly election is a much bigger exercise in one way or the other. Okay, if we say, number of polling stations remains the same for assembly election and Lok Sabha election. So Election Commission managed to hold the entire Madhya Pradesh assembly election on one day. But when it comes to Lok Sabha, you need 4 phases for Madhya Pradesh. What's the reason?
I don't know. It also leaves more room for opportunity for code of conduct violations to take place, is what I think.
Yes, what happens is that, see, look, what would happen. So in Bihar, there are 40 constituencies. Every phase, 6 or 7 constituencies will go to poll.
Correct.
Because it's a 7-phase poll, 6 constituencies roughly. So people will be voting in one constituency, and in the neighboring constituency, the campaign would be on, and in all probability, some big leader of the political party would be giving speeches. So this influences voters' mind. The whole idea of bringing campaign to a standstill 48 hours before polling is to give voters a peace of mind.
Agreed.
Allow him or her to think carefully after they have been bombarded by all kinds of promises by different political parties. Now the problem is that 48-hour respite voters are not going to get, because he would be voting in one constituency, and in the neighboring constituency, voters will be bombarded by lots of promises. It's not creating a level playing field, in a sense, for the entire state.
Of course, the conducting of the elections in a country as vast and geographically diverse as India is obviously a challenging exercise, but the rationale behind 7 phases, and certainly so many phases within single states, is one hard to understand. But while we are talking about the election, that is the spectacle of democracy, I can't let you go without also asking you a question about suffology. We are going to be seeing so many opinion polls coming up in the near future. So one of the things you had written for Open Magazine, once the Uttarakhand and UP opinion polls did not quite turn out the way the opinion polls had said, you had said suffologists are remembered more for their failures than for their successes, which is also the sort of thing we saw with Nate Silver and 538.com in America. During the Uttarakhand and UP elections, you had said that the sampling numbers were great, and yet the polls had failed to measure the mood of the election. Going into 2019, the general elections, what have been the lessons learned from those opinion polls, and how is suffology and how are opinion polls going to be different this time around?
No, I think now there is a challenge which is posed to the conventional style of polling. We still do the conventional style of polling, which is to say stratified random sample.
Correct.
Pick up constituencies randomly select the voters, and then we go and ask questions to the voter, keeping in mind that the voting question should not be asked in open, it should be asked secretly to maintain the secrecy. And we believe that once you allow voters to express their voting preference secretly, we would be able to read the mind of the voter in terms of his voting preference. I think now there's some challenge to that, because in Uttar Pradesh when we did the survey, and that was the case even in Chhattisgarh, because in that piece I didn't write Chhattisgarh because we did not fail in Chhattisgarh at the time. We again failed in Chhattisgarh this time. Chhattisgarh was a big failure because we predicted a wrong party to win. In spite of getting the profile of voters right, we tend to believe, and this is the design of doing a good poll, that you select till the last end, which is the voter. So we select constituencies randomly, we select locations randomly, and finally we select voters randomly, and that has always given us estimates which is closer to the, very close to the reality. We have done more than 120, 130 polls over the last 20, 30 years. And most of the time, we get vote share which is very close to the final outcome, even though sometimes there would be ifs and buts about converting these votes into seats. But in the recent times, recent last 2 years, we faced challenge twice, not one. One in Uttar Pradesh and one in Chhattisgarh. So I won't be able to say whether we have... We have learned lesson, in a sense, we have become more cautious. But what method to adopt, to improvise, I don't think that we have a very clear picture about that. We are doing a little bit of innovations, in a sense, when to ask this voting question, how to ask this voting question, because that's the heart and soul of this study. What we used to do earlier is to ask that question right at the beginning after two or three questions. Now we are carefully thinking whether it is appropriate to ask that question right at the beginning, to put it, insert it in the middle, or where to ask. And then we would normally rely, because that's what the technique suggests. If we are doing several rounds of poll, we always prefer to do a panel. So you keep going to the same location, same places, again and again to measure what is the change. And this is what the method suggests. If you want to measure change over a period of time, if you go to the same voters again and again, that's the best model. If you cannot follow that best model, at least you go to the same place again and again. And we've been doing that for a very long time, but post-UP election, we have changed our policy and we go to a different set of constituency if we do more than one round of poll. So these are some of the changes which we have adopted, and we'll think very carefully in 2019 when we start doing our polling.
The Deep Dive podcast series, an exclusive interview with Professor Sanjay Kumar, Director of CSPS.
Well, there you go, straight from the horse's mouth, Professor Sanjay Kumar of CSDS telling us what he thinks are going to be the outcomes of this election. BJP is still firmly in the driver's seat. BJP is still the stronger party when it comes to forming alliances. We will, of course, be bringing to you more political voices, political commentators going forward. So if you have anything to say to us, do write into us on mcpodcast@nw18.com, and we will keep you company as this dance of democracy, as they say. I've never understood why it's a dance. It's more like a fight to the death of democracy unfolds over the course of the coming few months. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, saying thank you for joining us, and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.